Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Offering us teachings, life is always offering us teachings, and it's usually the case that it's up to us to learn them, to listen, to attend, and to notice where the teachings that are being offered. If we're wise, then everything will teach us. But just as this evening, sitting here, we finished the chanting, and then we all noticed the rhythmic noise. At least I imagine we all did. So then the thought arises, what's that noise? Never heard that before. This is what my mind produced. Sounds like something dripping. And noticing that, okay, this is a sound. Don't know what the sound is. Is it inside? Is it outside? The mind picks it up and says, I wonder if someone's going to do something about that. Wonder if I should do something about that. Maybe I just leave it alone. See what happens. Maybe there's nothing to do. Now the mind, at that very moment, we can see the mind going out to an object, taking hold of it, grabbing hold of the sound, opinionating about it, worrying about it, interested in it, irritated by it. And I could see very easily, just the mind fixates on the noise, specifically in relating to it, not wanting it to be there, and then there's suffering instantly. And then as soon as the mind lets go and says, well, the sound is just a sound, then there's no suffering. Well, right here, there's the entire Buddhist path. So I might as well stop, actually. No. But since many of you have come many miles, and yeah, we'll have the longer hole in the roof discourse rather than the shorter hole in the roof discourse. Also, I was reminded of a conversation I had with a friend of ours in Portland, a Zen teacher, Chozen. And she was saying how they have a little center on the Columbia River Gorge outside of Portland, and it was summertime and they had a sesshin, and she's from the Rinzai Zen tradition, so they have a very tight routine in the Zendo, and so that, you know, once you go into the Zendo for sittings, then, you know, nobody moves except the person walking around with a big stick who whacks anybody who moves, and you sit very, very still for all the periods of Zazen. And this retreat was happening in the summertime, I think, July or August, and it was really, really hot. And the Zendo at that time was an old farm building that had been converted, so tin-roofed farm building, and it was absolutely cooking inside. So this is about the third or fourth day of the Sesshin, and everyone is sweltering in this heat during the days. And so finally it built up so much and that this heat wave was continuing and increasing to such a degree that she realized she had to do something. And so then she and her husband Hogan had the idea of, oh, let's put the sprinklers on the roof. Right, cool the whole place down. Excellent, that's a good idea. So then Hogan's pretty handy with these kind of things, and so he could have got up there and set up this hose on the roof, and the sprinklers were spraying the roof of the Zendo and cooling the whole thing down with water. And so then this did reduce the temperature somewhat. And anyway, during the day, in the Zen tradition, they have these interviews, sort of formalized interviews with the teacher, where the teacher sits in Zazen, and then the ding rings a bell, in comes the student, and then you have these sort of little Dharma exchanges, and then ding, the student goes out, and the next one comes in, and the interviews are quite brief and somewhat formalized, but there's a real exchange that goes on between the teacher and the student. And anyway, so that afternoon she has her session of interviews, and ding, in comes the first one, says, "Oh, I love you so much. What a relief. Oh, I was really cooking, I was roasting to death in there. And just the sound of that water is just like, it's heaven, it's bliss. Just as soon as I heard it begin, my heart was so relieved. I love you. This is wonderful. Thank you so much." Bowed and walked out. Ding, next one comes in. "I think I'm going to go crazy. The heat was bad enough, and now I get this water. This incredibly irritating noise. It's just driving me nuts. No, the heat was bad enough, and now this is too much. I'm pretty determined to stay through the end of the retreat, but wow, and this carries on for the next couple of days, I'm really going to burst." Ding. "The fire of the heart is cooled by the rain of Dharma. The interfusion of the cosmic heat with the coolness of the Dharma principle brings about the true liberation of the heart." Ding. I'm very concerned about the conservation of water resources here in the Columbia Gorge area, and I've been doing well with this retreat, but I really find it's very, very hard for me to deal with this kind of sheer water wastage. I mean, I think we're all quite happy with the heat, and we'll have to be, but I know that you're eco-friendly and sensitive people, but we really have to bear this in mind. We can't just pour water into the ground heedlessly. This is very undharmic, and the heart is deeply troubled by this insensitive wastage. Ding. If you really worked it out right, you could have a timer on that system. And that there'll be ways that you could have it going so that you wouldn't have to ding. This is a genuine historical non. Five in a row, all had completely different worlds they were living in. What does the mind do with its objects? And so Chosen is like, wow, it's just water. how interesting the different realms that that we can create and wander around in just from the sound of water, or even just sitting here noticing how you know the drip begins, and then you think, oh, what's that noise? Like a scratched record. A scratch in a record, a scratch in a silent record. Then you hear the other rain. Say, isn't that interesting? The other rain is not irritating because that's just rain. But then this one other noise shouldn't be there. The rain's okay, but the other noise is not okay. Isn't that interesting? The mind going out, grabbing its object, being born into it. Then it lets go, and comes back, and then it's just a sound. I often mentioned the teachings that Ajahn Chah would give about this. He would regularly tell a story of how he was, when he was a younger monk traveling on Tudong, wandering in the countryside. He was camped in a forest near a village at one time, and that evening, there are a lot of times they have festivals and such like at night time rather than the day, because everyone's working during the daylight hours, and in those days villages often didn't have electricity at all, and the night was also cooler and more convivial for partying and so forth. So there was some kind of festival going on in the village that night, and they had a lot of noise and had some amplified sound, you know, PA system going and big racket going on. And first of all, Ajahn Chah found himself getting irritated with the noise, but it was late at night, it was after 11 or so, and he'd been practicing hard all day. But he saw what his mind was doing, and as he sat down to meditate, his mind became very concentrated, and he noticed that if he wanted to, he could pay attention to the sound, you know, if the mind went out to it. But then he also found that he could turn away from the sound. He could let go of it, and to the point where the sound would disappear altogether. But he reflected, isn't that interesting that when the mind goes out, it's like the sound is irritating me. But when we let go, then it's just the sound. The sound isn't making any effort to annoy you at all. It's just like Ajahn Pasana didn't set up the little feed hose in the ceiling to say, let's give them a test. Saturday night, they all come expectant. What are you, nice peaceful sitting in a Dhamma talk? You know, let's wind them up a bit and see what happens. See if Heidi can get a hose in the roof and feed it through. No, nature provides plentiful opportunities for these things. There's no effort being made to create annoyance. The mind goes out and grabs it and creates that itself. But the sound is just a sound. It's just water moving through air, water hitting the ground, or villagers having a party. It's just sound. Air vibrating, hitting the ear. It's utterly innocent, pure in its own right. It's what the mind does with it, and what we make of it that turns it into a problem. You might have hunted through a record stores and second-hand bargain bins for years and years, trying to find this rare edition of a John Cage silent record with a scratch on it. And sat cheerfully at home. Finally, after years and years of searching, he finally got the Water Drip Symphony. Actually, he did do one called Water Music, but it was a bit more colourful. You know, then it's the very same sound. It can be something that we desire. And, yeah, great, found it at last. And it's the heart is delighted with it. So just this is, it really encapsulates so much of what the Buddhist practice involves and points us to how we create suffering. That the sound is not there to annoy us. It's we who go and annoy the sound. We go out, grab it, and say, you shouldn't be this way. And just that very position creates dukkha right there. Last winter, I remember we were mentioned a few times some teachings of Lungpo Dun, who is a great elder master in Thailand, who he was a disciple of Ajahn Mun, our Dharma grandfather. He was Ajahn Chah's teacher. And Lungpo Dun settled, well, originally it was in Surin, his monastery. He started in Surin province, which is a place that has an elephant festival every year. And the town becomes very noisy and very busy. And so that one of this particular teaching that Ajahn Pasno translated, he said when someone came to him and said, you know, Lumpur, every year there's this huge festival and this big racket and all these tourists come and there's this whole to-do for about 2 or 3 weeks, it really disturbs the monastery. It wouldn't be better, you know, and also by now, you know, the monastery is right here. I mean, Surin used to be a pretty quiet little country town back in the old days, and now it's this big, busy city. Wouldn't it be better to move your monastery to somewhere out in the country where it's a lot more quiet? And Lungpo Dun's response was, you know, why do you concern yourself with going out and engaging with the busyness? If you maintain your practice, then just leave the busyness of the city and the noise as it is, and then there's no problem. You know, he saw it was a non-issue, you know, if one was practicing correctly. He also, there's a very beautiful way that he reformulated the Four Noble Truths in the light of that kind of insight, where he said, he changed the order a little bit, where he said, the cause of suffering is the mind going out and grabbing hold of its objects. The result of the mind having gone out and grabbed an object is suffering. The path is the mind leaving hold of, letting go of the objects that it's grabbed, and the result, the cessation of suffering is the result of the mind having let go of its objects. Very simple. I think it's a rough paraphrase, so, but it's very, very simple, very graphic and easy for us to relate to. We all know that experience. We can be familiar with that. Also, the other day we were one of the Dharma readings. I was reminded of a thing that Master Hua said when he was in England and visiting with a whole group of his monks and nuns that he was traveling with through Europe. This was back in 1989, I believe. And somebody at Amaravati Monastery asked him, you know, you have these hundreds of monastic disciples and thousands of lay disciples, and you have these 20 or 30 different monasteries and centers all over the world. How on earth do you manage to integrate everything that's going on, and how do you manage to stay peaceful in the middle of it? And Master Hua's response was simply, I don't go out, I stay in. Which didn't mean to say he was locked up in some sort of little ivory tower at Mission Control and was not allowing any irritating influences to get at him. But it meant obviously he stayed in his heart. He stayed at home, but he was not allowing his mind to go out and to get absorbed into its objects, to get born into things. There's that quality of at-homeness, staying in, that kind of keeping to the resting at the back wall, at the very quality of knowing, of pure awareness, and not leaving that place. Now, it's also important to understand how this works, because we might think of, not going out, staying in, or not the mind not going out to grab hold of its objects, is implying some kind of disengaged or insensitive state. But it's people like Lumpur Dun or Master Hua or Lumpur Cha. These were all people who had many, many disciples and were engaged with people and activities and decision making and directing and initiating projects and different things over and over on a daily basis. Complex, intricate conditions and responsibilities, from the outside looking like a whole massive but a burdensome task. So it's not so obviously there's engagement going on. So it's really important to get a sense of what this means in terms of how we practice. Letting go of objects is not a matter of switching off from them or desensitizing the mind or ignoring the world of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought, feeling, emotion, memory. Volition. It's not that at all. Trying to create some sort of little bubble of safety where nothing will impinge and irritate or hurt me is a guaranteed way to cause suffering very, very quickly. But it's the Buddha's way is directed towards this marvelous quality of balance. The middle way itself is where there's utter attunement to the way things are, attunement to the world of thought and sense, feeling, and simultaneously a complete non-attachment, a complete non-identification with that. Now, this is the mysterious middle way, the harmonious chord that is the aim of Buddhist practice. And we can, it's difficult to find that. We can, and certainly it's. Training, the initial part of the training is a lot to do with just getting some kind of control on the outgushing, the outflowing habits of the mind, the ogres and the asavas, the outflows and the floods. That just getting some degree of control and actually just being able to stay in and be bolted in and not be chasing after things is important. So just sometimes the need to go against that habitual current of outgoingness can mean that we need to lean a bit more severely towards the dissociation, detachment, non-engagement. So one shouldn't be totally afraid of that. So that sometimes we can be so afraid of developing a nihilistic or negative, life-rejecting desensitized mind state that we think, oh no, I've got to keep open to everything, I've got to keep open to everything. But so we never really develop enough of the muscles that we need to just be able to hold back. So initially, often that's the case, to be able to just train the heart to whatever comes up, just leave it alone, leave it alone, leave it alone, leave it alone. Sometimes, you know, going against instinct or seeming to be a bit more kind of insensitive or impractical. But occasionally that's not a bad thing, just to be able to cut off the habit of reactivity. Also earlier this evening, when the wind was lashing the rain against the doors, what brings this to mind was an incident that happened years and years ago when I was at Chidhurst Monastery in England, and I was putting a great deal of effort into formal practice in those days, and the Chidhurst Monastery, that is the main building, is a large Victorian house, and in those days we only had one cabin in the forest, and everyone else, the male community, lived in the house. And then the women lived at the nun's cottage, about half a mile away. So it was very convenient that the distance between the shrine room, meditation space, and your living space was a staircase, rather than half a mile through the forest as it is here. So I would, you know, very often spend my evenings in the shrine room, and after the evening session, Ajahn Sumedho would give a talk. Then, you know, several of us would often sit and meditate longer in the evening. So during this period, I forget whether we had a retreat on or it was just an ordinary time, but I was sitting there one evening, and I had made the, as I often did, a resolution that I would just sit there until I got tired and weary, and it was time to rest, then I'd get up and go to my room and lie down to sleep. And so this one evening I was sitting there, and my mind was very, very bright all the way through the evening sitting, through the Dhamma talk, and then afterwards it was, you know, very, very alert, and, you know, was doing the meditation on the inner sound in those days, listening to the nada sound, and it was very, very clear, bright. And so I was sat there, and I thought, okay, well, just as usual, I'll sit here until I get tired. And also, my body was very, you know, relaxed. So often I'd say, okay, and I won't move until I absolutely have to. I won't change my posture until I absolutely have to. So to my surprise, 10 o'clock went by, 11 o'clock went by, midnight went by, and you know, my body wasn't getting uncomfortable, and my mind was still, you know, totally alert and bright, I thought. And so the thought arises, well, I should be getting tired soon. This is carrying on for a while. But I think, well, hang on, you know, you said this. Don't change your posture till it hurts, and don't go rest till you need to. And the fact was, I didn't need to do either. And so 12 o'clock goes by, and during this time, there's this storm had begun, and there was howling wind and lashing rain on the windows. And at about 12:30, there's this noise outside the window. Meow. Doris. Doris, who features in many, many Dhamma talks of from those days, was a great character of our early life at Chidhurst Monastery. So Doris was out there, and about 5 or 10 minutes, there are these indignant squeaks and mules coming from outside the window, and then they went away. So I was sat there thinking, no, I've made my vow, I'm not going to move from this spot, you know, until I need to. I'm not going to go and rest, I'm not going to change my posture until I have to. So then, yeah, about 3/4 of an hour later, you know, 1 o'clock's gone by now, it's like 1:15, 1:30, back she comes. Like, there's obviously no other way into the house, and she's done the whole circuit a couple of times. Let me in. And so I'm sitting there, and so of course I now find myself an even deeper moral dilemma. Like, so it's just a sound, ignore it, you know, back to the nada, let go. So I'm hearing Doris say, I can't believe this guy, he's supposed to be a monk, aren't you guys supposed to be kind to animals, that kind of thing? What the hell do you think you're doing? What's this got to do with holiness? Let me in. What kind of a creep are you out here, foul weather, wind, rain, middle of the night, freezing cold, soaking wet? How'd you like to be out here? Let me in. Back to the nada. So finally, around about, you know, after another half hour of agonizing, and Doris is being extremely persistent, finally, yeah, I got up and opened the door, let her in. About time! What do you think you're doing? Let her in, and then went and sat down in my seat and carried on. And then, carried on with the meditation, and then reflected how, well, you know, you'd made this resolution not to move from that spot, and that was, you know, a sincere and noble aspiration, but is that necessarily the path? And it was a really powerful teaching from Doris that taking things on an external level, and certainly keeping one's resolutions is something that's important. When you make a determination like that, then you should keep that to some extent. But then, you know, if what does not moving from my spot mean? You know, is it, if we just take it at the level of the body and the world of form, kaya viveka, like physical level, then certainly it means not moving from this mat. But isn't it more important to not move from the meditation spot internally, the citta viveka, the seclusion of the heart? And so, and I noticed that, because my mind was still kind of very bright and clear, I just got up, I was aware of standing up, I was aware of walking through the door, I was aware of opening the outside door, aware of Doris's indignation, utter contempt. and then aware of closing the door, going back to my mat, sitting down. Nothing had changed. Then, you know, the nada sound was going on the whole time. You know, what had been the big deal? So that, you know, I could see that, well, there was a point in sustaining that kind of resolution to establish a degree of strength. But if we get stuck on it, if we take that just at face value, then our common sense and our natural compassion and so forth can be, we're having to override that or switch that off, or we're not, we've ceased coming from a place of Dhamma. And are coming from a place of idealism or theory or habit. So that was a very potent teaching. And so Doris came and joined me in the shrine room and found a nice piece of radiator to dry out against. And as it happened, I found I just sat there till the morning bell went at 4 o'clock, and just didn't get tired that night. There was also there. I could see that there was this the inner record breaker was like, "Hey, Doris, I've made it to 4 hours. Come on, I'm gonna." I still wasn't uncomfortable. I thought, and my mind was going, "Hey, wow, this would be really cool if I can just sit here without moving till the morning chanting. That would be really, that would be something I could really mention in Dhamma talks." Like, "Hey, Doris, you're going to break my record. This is." So I could see, interesting. That's this sort of narcissistic, inflated champion Dharma farer syndrome was going to be interrupted by this irritating compassion. "Doris, you're ruining my self-inflation program. How dare you?" So when we consider this not moving, not moving from that place, these are all kind of interlocked and interrelated, these concepts that we talk about. The purpose of the training is to stop suffering. So it's not a matter of drip or no drip. It's interesting that it stopped as soon as the Dhamma talk began. But the point of the training is suffering or no suffering, and this is something that's always good to keep in mind. So when we contemplate the sense world, and then we use this kind of language, going out, the mind going out, or staying at the back wall, these kind of phrases, it's important also to bear in mind these are relative. It's a relative use of language, and that it's, even if we conceive an in here, there's a me in here, or even a knowing in here, and there's a sense world out there, then even that can, if we make that too solid, then that becomes a dualistic view and a source of maybe subtle but still a persistent source of dukkha as well. I think it's fair enough to use that as a model. I find, like, say, Lumpo Dun's rendition of the Four Noble Truths or the teachings on Atamayata, very helpful image in that sense of the feeling of the knowing or the quality of awareness being here and the sense objects out there, like in the visual field or a noise out there somewhere out in the world or a thought somewhere in the newer sphere, the mental realm inside that the attention goes to. It goes from here to there. Atamayata, just to say a word about that, this is it literally means not made of that. And in the Buddha's time, the concept of perception, say particularly visual perception or auditory perception, say that an energy moves out from the eye, goes and occupies an object, say the door handle. I see the door handle. So this the energy goes out, occupies the door handle, assumes the shape of that door handle, and then returns to the eye. The energy conforms with the object, and then comes back bearing that image. That was the concept of perception in the Buddha's time. So tanmayata means consisting of that or formed of that. And so that when we in our habitual unawakened ways of perception, we follow that process and we say the door handle is out there, I'm here, I am Ajahn Amaro, and I'm looking at and talking about the door handle which is over there. And so that atamayata is means literally not consisting of that or not made of that. It's referring to that quality of staying at home, of not going out, of not letting the mind's energy go out and occupy its objects and then be depleted in that way, and then returning with the object. But that it's like a non-fabrication of the world, not making the world an external thing full of solid objects, or not making even thoughts and ideas solid realm of emotions or my memories or my plans the solid real things. It's staying at home with the quality of knowing and awareness itself. It's leaving things alone, essentially. So this is also a very helpful term to be acquainted with and to know, and to use as a way of working with the habits of perception, the way the mind grabs a sound or a thought or a visual object and inflates it with meaning and with value. Like, don't like, want, don't want, interesting, boring, useful, uninteresting, dangerous, etc., etc. One of the teachings that the Buddha gave, which takes it a stage further, which is very helpful to be acquainted with and to contemplate, is talking about this very, even using the structure of here and there, of outside and inside, subject and object. And this one teaching that encapsulates this most fully is the Buddha's teaching to Bahiya, who was a wanderer. It's one of these situations where Bahiya was an ascetic and a teacher, a spiritual teacher, and had many disciples, and was under the impression that he was an enlightened being. And one night a devatar appeared to him, who apparently used to be a relative of his when the devatar was a human, and manifested before him and said, well, Bahiya, venerable sir, not only are you not enlightened, you're not an arahant, but you're not doing anything whereby you could become an arahant. And so Bahiya was obviously not proud, and said, oh dear. And so his response was, well, are there any enlightened beings in the world? And the devotee said, oh yes, indeed, there is the Samana Gautama, the Buddha. Bahiya immediately, instead of again being proud and saying, well, what makes him so enlightened? What's wrong with me? Said, well, how can I find this person? Which direction do I go? And the devata told him where the Buddha was living, and he immediately set off on a journey to find the Buddha. He was living somewhere near the coast, and set off walking into Savatthi, inland into Magadha, several hundred miles, and so was keen, desperate to meet the Buddha, had this great sense of urgency about him. And so then, as the story goes, he encountered the Buddha on the streets of actually I think he was staying at Rajagaha. Anyway, he encountered the Buddha on the street, and and approached him and bowed and asked the Buddha to teach him the Dhamma. And the Buddha said, well, this isn't the right time, Bahiya. We're on arms round, and this isn't a convenient time to be teaching. And Bahiya said, life is uncertain. We never know when we're going to die. Please teach me the Dhamma. He said, well, Bahiya, this is not the right time. We're on arms round. And Bahiya said, life is uncertain. Of course, everything is done three times, as people know. in Buddhist tradition, and then the Buddha, after Bahia asks the third time, says, life is uncertain, if we wait, either you or I might die, and then I will not hear the Dhamma, so please teach me the Dhamma. And the Buddha says, well, since you pressed the Tathagata three times, then the Tathagata cannot refuse. And then he gave Bahia this teaching, which was, he said, in the seen there is only the seen, in the heard there is only the heard, in the cognized there is only the cognized, in the sensed there is only the sensed. Thus Bahia, you should not see anything as being there. And as you see by here that there is no thing there, then you should also see that indeed there is no thing here. Realizing there is no thing there and no thing here, you should not look for yourself at any place between the two either. This by here is the end of suffering. I remember years ago one of the Anagarikas saying that for years, because Ajahn Viradhamma used to talk about this this sutta very, very often. It was a very frequent theme, and he said, you know, I thought when he said in the scene there is only the scene, I thought he meant scene as in S-C-E-N-E, you know? And in the herd, like, you know, the herd of cows, or in the herd of people, it's like, in the scene there's only the scene, in the herd, amongst the herd of people, amongst the common crowd. And he had this whole little extra thesis going. So this is, you know, a very useful teaching, meditation teaching, to contemplate and to look into deeply. The Buddha saying to Bahia, when the seen, the heard, the sensed, the cognized, we see that there is no thing there, and we see that there is no thing, no solid, actual, independent quality, object, thing that is there out in the objective world. And then similarly, when we see there's no thing there, we see there's the perception of door handle, but that's actually just an impression in the mind. And from the point of view of a conditioned human who speaks English, that's a reasonable judgment. But it's only one point of view for what that is. And besides that, it's happening, it's perceived in this mind. And similarly, when we see there's no solid, actual, real external object there, then similarly the subject, we see there is no thing here. There is no subject, no experience, solid, independent experiencer who is knowing that. And then when we let go, when there's a letting go of subject and object, of here and there, of this and that. And again, the Buddha sort of makes this little extra clause of, not anywhere between the two either. There's no thing here, there's no thing there, and there's nothing in between the two either. Then there's this radical letting go, as a seeing of that all here and there, subject, object, this and that, all dualities are creations from the conditioning of the heart to the sensory and conceptual world. And that when the heart lets go, when there is a real opening to Dhamma, to the way things truly are, then there's the end of suffering. So this is, you know, one can get tangled up in these kind of teachings, or if we try and conceptualize about it too much, then we can get in a bit of a knot. So it's important to bear in mind that these kind of teachings are things to contemplate and to look at the individual pieces in meditation, and to pick it up and to reflect, well, what is there-ness, what is here-ness, what is subject, what is object, what is this and that, how does that happen, how do we create that, is that created? Just, you know, exploring it in the environment of meditation practice. So it's not just something that we're just blindly memorizing or believing or disbelieving or trying to conceptualize, but we actually feel it out on an experiential level and see, let the heart see for itself, oh right, here and there, how could they not be just relative constructs, subject-object? Aha, I see how that works. Letting go of the world out there, of thought and of mountains and trees and people. Letting go of the self, of the sense of self, of I, the doer, the experiencer, the one living a life passing through time. And in the moment, just seeing directly in our own heart, in our own practice, when the heart lets that go in that moment, then the suffering ceases. There's no dukkha, there's no discord, there's just Dhamma, which is pure, peaceful, easeful. Another of the teachings on this that Ajahn Chah was very very fond of and employed a lot was in the same collection of teachings that the story of Bahia comes from in the Udana, where the Buddha is describing the unconditioned reality, the Asankata Dhamma, the ultimate truth. And he says something like, there is that sphere of being where there is, which is the unborn, the unconditioned, the uncreated, where is there is no sun, no moon, no stars, no this world, no other world, and that realm, that sphere of being, is neither a moving forward, neither a stopping still, nor a moving backwards. It has no basis, no development, no support. This is the end of suffering. Again, this is not a teaching to sort of theorize a lot about or make a whole big metaphysical structure out of, but it's a meditation teaching. Ajahn Chah used to particularly stress or pick up this element of it is neither moving forward, it's neither a moving forwards nor a moving backwards nor a stopping still. And that he obviously contemplated that a great deal. You know, what is that? How can there be that which is neither moving forwards nor moving backwards nor standing still? What is that? How can that be? And he, in the last few months of his teaching, he would often put this out to people. In the last few years, he would often speak on this theme. You know, if you can't go forward and you can't go back and you can't stand still, where do you go? In fact, it was the very last message that he ever sent to Ajahn Sumedho just before his health collapsed in 1981. He wrote a letter to Ajahn Sumedho, which was a completely unprecedented event. He wasn't a big writer, to put it mildly. And he had one of the Western monks take dictation one day. And he said, and this, the last message to Ajahn Sumedho was, the Buddha Dharma, whenever you have feelings of love or hate for anything whatsoever, these will be your aids and partners in building paramita. The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. This, Sumedho, is your place of non-abiding. It's pretty all-encompassing final instructions. So you know, here was Ajahn Sumedho gone to England, starting up this new monastery, bringing the Dhamma to the West. And so rather than a whole list of things to do and things not to do, Ajahn Chah just gave him the sort of the key to the root principle. So this is the place to not abide, Sumedho. Well, this is the place to abide, this place of non-abiding. The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. So that when we're faced with that, there's a conundrum, because we see the world, and here I am, I'm sitting on this mat, and Ajahn is on my right, and Thangkhrun Dhamma is on my left, and this is a Vyagiri, and I'm facing to the west, and today's Saturday, and you know, everyone is gathered here, and this is all fine and normal and true on a relative plane. But as long as I think that I'm a human being who exists as this solid independent entity moving through time and space, who has a past and a future and a geographical location, then there's suffering. There's a subtle level of suffering, but it's the root delusion of independent identity and the idea of I am an independent being existing in time and space. And that what this teaching points to, this indication of the unconditioned reality, that this mysterious sphere of being, which you know, you just use that kind of phrase, and unconditioned sphere of being, out the twilight zone again. But it's actually the dearest and most precious core of our own heart that we're talking about. It's nothing remote or strange or forbidding or intangible. It's actually our heart's most dearly loved quality state. And what it's pointing to is that as long as we're looking for liberation or satisfaction or happiness in terms of being an individual being or being somewhere, or there's always going to be suffering. And it's only in that moment when the heart lets go of the sense of self, it lets go of physical location, it lets go of space, being here, let's go of time, let's go of self, let's go of space. In that complete letting go, then there is dukkha nirodha, the cessation of suffering, there's complete happiness, contentment. Because if you think about it, geography only applies to the body. The mind isn't anywhere, right? Three-dimensional space only applies to Rupa Khanda, to the form Khanda. The other four Khandas of perception, feeling, mental formations, consciousness, geography does not apply, right? So the body cannot be liberated. We're not liberated in the body, we're liberated in mind. So we're liberated in a place where there's no geography. I'm not trying to get too abstruse, but just, you know, getting the point. This is what it's pointing to, is like, but the realm of the body and form grabs our attention so intently that we forget that, hey, you know, the sense of being someplace, of a here and a there, of this and of that, that only comes from the conditioning of the physical realm. When the heart lets go of the conditioned realm, the physical realm, the realm of the born and the created, then there's a possibility of freedom. As long as we see the material world and the conditions of mind as solid and real, then we can't experience true freedom. But these kind of reflections point us to where that freedom can be found. And obviously you can't just decide, oh well, I'll just let go of time, space and self. Poop. Yeah, well maybe we can. Maybe if the drop lands on our head in the right moment. Yes. But maybe it doesn't happen so quickly. But at least we have some clear direction and a sense of what needs to be done. And that's why Ajahn Chah would encourage a sort of investigation, reflecting on this conundrum. If you can't go forwards, you can't go back. You can't stand still. Where do you go? You can't go sideways either. Well, it's a trick, because you can't go anywhere. And going doesn't apply. So that's what it's forcing us to. So I'm giving the answer to the koan. It's forcing us for the heart to waken up to that quality of its own nature, which is timeless, selfless, spaceless. To wake up to that, to know that, and to slowly, steadily train the heart to rest in that, to trust that, and to see the dukkha ceasing. Anyone? Sarukaram Naramase.